Please say good morning and welcome to Denver, Colorado. The book is entitled 6 Million Crucifixions. Gabriel Walensky is our guest. Thank you, sir, and welcome to the city, and thank you for coming on the show, man. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
A little bit about your background, and again, I find myself in all the history I've read in total agreement with you, and I've said we've angered people before. I suspect we will anger them this morning as well, but a little bit about your background first.
Sure. I am actually not a traditional academic that typically writes this sort of book. I am a computer guy. My background is in software development. So I'm a technical guy. I have been working in the computer industry for over 25 years or so. But I have been fascinated by this topic for much longer than that even. Mm-hmm. So for the longest time, I have been studying the subject until I finally decided to write a book about it.
I hear an accent. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Argentina.
Interesting.
I was born in Uruguay, but I grew up in Argentina, and I came to the U.S. 25 years ago or so.
One of the great places the Nazis went.
This is true. This is true. They actually gave them shelter after the war.
Yeah.
Perón, who was the president of the country at the time, mm-hmm. was a very fascist president, and he really admired Hitler and his ideology, and he gave them shelter.
Yes, he did. Even if you watch the Peronist troops march, they used to goose step.
Yes, yes, it was pretty horrible, actually. So the Nazis actually found a safe haven there, and they even founded cities. And
yeah,
you go to some places in Argentina, and the descendants of these Nazis live there. Mm-hmm. They still dress in traditional Bavarian clothes during the Oktoberfest.
They celebrate Hitler's birthday?
No, they don't go that far.
No, I mean, I've read stories that in the 50s, if those members of the Odessa that got away would hold celebrations in Argentina.
They might do something like this in private, but certainly...
No, not in the open.
Yeah, not in the open.
But the Odessa was real.
There were organizations that helped Nazis escape for sure. And as a matter of fact, in my book, 6 Million Crucifixions, I discuss another organization that helped Nazis escape, and that was the Vatican.
Yeah.
And many of the major war criminals that made it to Argentina, like Mengele and mm-hmm. Adolf Eichmann and others, were helped by the Vatican to do that.
Why, if there's been such controversy about Pope Pius and his role or his lack of a role in protecting Jews of Italy or Jews of Europe, and there's a book entitled Hitler's Pope, I've read that book, and then there's another book that came out that came after the man who wrote the book Hitler's Pope. What do you do with those two critiques, and what do you believe about Pius?
Well, I personally think that Hitler's Pope, the book by John Cornwell, mm-hmm. It goes a little too far. I don't think Pope Pius the 12th can be rightly be called Hitler's Pope. I think Pius the 12th was not necessarily a Nazi sympathizer. He didn't really like Nazism. He didn't particularly like Hitler either. So... But one thing that Pius did was he tacitly acknowledged at least, that out of the two evils of the world, communism and mm-hmm. Nazism was the lesser of the two. Not only that, but he also believed that Nazism was the only possibility to fight communism, which he really believed was the true evil of the world.
And the German industrialists had the same view.
Of course, everybody in Germany thought that communism was the biggest evil, but Pius had the option to choose something else. He could have actually went and allied himself with Churchill or Roosevelt, mm-hmm. but he didn't do that. And the reason why was because he didn't believe that the Allies, the British and the Americans, had what it took mm-hmm. to beat Stalin. Mm-hmm. And Pius was convinced that communism was the greatest evil, and it was bent on destroying Christianity. And ultimately, I think he was right. I think that if mm-hmm. the world had been conquered by the Soviet Union, I think they would have obliterated Christianity.
They also made a deal. I mean, it's the creation of the Vatican. Mussolini makes a deal, and the Vatican gets created. They're no longer papal captivity, but they make a deal to create the state.
This is true.
And that happens under Mussolini.
That happened in Mussolini. It happened in the 20s mm-hmm. With the Lateran. So the pact that they made with Mussolini was that they would, it was quite similar in some regards to the pact that they made with Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
It was a deal where they made the secular authorities would leave them alone to do religious education and so on, in exchange for
recognition.
For non-participation in political affairs.
But they also recognized that then they would recognize the establishment of the fascist state and recognize Victor Emmanuel and recognize, and then there was a trade, and they created the Vatican State. The Vatican State had been held in captivity since Garibaldi.
Yes, exactly. So before then it was the Papal States.
It was a
national entity that actually dominated most of Italy.
Absolutely.
But when Italy was liberated, they actually had to do something different. And Mussolini and Pius XI actually made this deal.
Mm-hmm.
But
and
the interesting thing about making deals, though, is the more interesting of the two, though, is the what was called the Reichskonkordat, which was a deal made between Pius XI, signed by Cardinal Pacelli, later Pius XII, and Hitler. And that was a deal signed in 1933 between the Vatican and Nazi Germany. And this was the very first agreement, or the very first recognition from a foreign power to Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And this was very, very important for a number of reasons. One of them was that it gave Nazi Germany recognition that it didn't have before.
Mm-hmm.
And in the eyes of not only the Germans themselves, but also all the world. And in the case of the Germans themselves, this was instrumental because before the Concordat, the Catholic Church had a ban on membership in the Nazi Party.
Mm-hmm.
So Catholics were not allowed to be members of the Nazi Party.
Mm-hmm.
When the Concordat was signed, this was not intended by the Vatican, but it was perceived by Catholics in Germany as a green light.
Yep.
To do that. And at that point, they lifted the ban. The bishops in Germany lifted the ban, Catholic Germans joined the Nazi Party in droves.
Yep.
At that point, you know, the floodgates were open past that point.
And Hitler was raised a Catholic. As a boy, he was a Catholic.
Yeah, yeah. He wanted to be an abbot, actually.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Hitler was, and that's another interesting point, because Hitler not only was born and raised as a Catholic, but he died as a Catholic, which is perhaps even more important to the sad story of Pius XII's participation during World War II.
I find both of those guys. Both Stalin was raised, put in a seminary.
Yes.
And Hitler was, his mother was very devout. He loved loved his mother. I mean, there's everything written about his mother. He didn't care for his father, but he loved his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to church.
Very true, and they are. As a matter of fact, they are actually buried in the in the cemetery right next to the church in Austria.
I'm going to keep you. You're wonderful. Hang on, please, if you could. The book is 6 Million Crucifixions. This guy's everything I hoped him be. Gabriel, can you stay with us? Hang on, sir.
Absolutely.
All right, it's 45, the high today. We got snow in the city. This is good stuff. Hang on your hats. We're coming back. Well, it's snowing in the city right now, but it's going to lead to great-looking lawns this weekend. Good morning. It's Wednesday, the April 7th edition, 630 KHW, Denver's Talk Station. 45 is all we get today. You know what the roads are like. 61 tomorrow, 69 Friday, 70s on Saturday and Sunday. This guy's wonderful, sitting talking off the air, and I do it sometimes with great guests, and this guy I could just listen to forever. Gabriel Walensky is our guest. 6 Million Crucifixions is the book. It's an advance. It'll be out, I guess, sometime in the next 4 or 5 days. But it's the role of Christianity in the birth of the Holocaust. But it all really has its roots in pogroms and back to actually the Apostle Paul, if everything I read is true. And I've read so much of this. But we're talking off the air, and he's a really brilliant guy. Really, really like your depth of your knowledge. But we were talking about on so much now on History Channel, which I have always dubbed the Hitler Channel, and I'm a big fan of the History Channel. Again and again and again, the dipping into the occult and the rise of the Nazis. But as kind of a buff about reading about the Führer's life, I don't think he believed much of that. What is your take on that, Gabe?
I agree, Peter. I mean, Hitler was born and raised a Catholic, but mm-hmm. he didn't believe in God. And by the time he got to power, he definitely was an atheist. But he did believe in the occult, like a lot of his other minions, Heinrich Himmler.
Himmler, yeah.
Himmler, the leader of the SS, was a big time into that,
yes.
and many of the other members of the Nazi elite were into the occult.
Yeah, Goebbels was into astrology, and they were into the occult. But by and large, that wasn't Adolf Hitler, was it?
No, he was not too much into it. But you know, keep in mind that Hitler was very, very capable, and I mean, he was very evil, but he was very capable.
Absolutely.
And he understood quite clearly how to manipulate the masses. And when he got to power, actually even before he got to power, he knew what made them tick, and he understood quite clearly what things to say and how to say them. And this is one of the reasons why he was so successful in manipulating the masses toward hitting Jews.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you think about it, it was almost preposterous. What he was saying would make no sense to a modern person, and would you know, somebody listening to him today would actually dismiss him as a lunatic. But he was not dismissed as a lunatic, and the reason why was because he was speaking to the masses almost in religious tones,
yes.
and he was portraying himself in religious imagery.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, in my book, I actually have a poster from the time when Hitler appears in front of the rays of light coming from the heavens,
the triumph of the will.
Yeah, and so he knew how to portray himself
Absolutely.
In messianic and religious terms. And when he spoke to the masses, he spoke to them in similar terms. He spoke about providence this and
mm-hmm.
providence that,
mm-hmm.
and he and also when it came to his hatred of Jews, which had no limit, you know, he basically tapped on a reservoir of hatred that was already there. And when he spoke to the masses in his speeches, he used imagery from the teachings of Christianity.
Yep.
He basically compared Jews to
rats
and vermin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and he actually used other imagery that was similar to what had been used by the church and by Christianity early on.
I agree. It's, you know, the whole notion of as Hitler as Messiah, you know, he's coming.
Absolutely.
It's incredible. It's ingrained. You know, when I was in grad school, I went and read the original Grimm brothers, and all the Grimms did, it's interesting I get to talk to you about this, but the Grimms, Jacob and Wilhelm, and they just went around Austria, Germany, and Bavaria, and they collected stories. They didn't write those stories. They collected them.
Right.
And in every one of the cases, and there wasn't a witch or anything, that's all been sanitized. It was Jews. You know, Hansel and Gretel, you know, little blonde, blue-eyed children, it was the Jews that got them, and the Jews got people. And that stuff was around and deeply ingrained in that culture for generations before he showed up.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's actually, to today modern listeners, I mean, if anybody goes and listens to or reads the stuff that was said mm-hmm. about the Jews during the Middle Ages, you know, before the Grimm brothers, obviously, but the kind of stuff that was said
mm-hmm.
about them at the time, the kind of stuff that was believed about them
yeah.
is astonishing, actually.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and Martin Luther, who is, of course, you know, the father of Lutheranism, Luther was an enormous anti-Semite.
Yes, as a matter of fact, well, he didn't start that way.
No.
He has an interesting story because he actually wanted to convert the Jews like all the other Christians
mm-hmm.
at the time. That was his mission because, you know, in Christianity believes that redemption and
mm-hmm.
will come, you know, the second coming of Christ will come when the Jews convert to
right.
Christianity.
Right.
So Luther wanted to convert Jews, and he tried this for many, many years until he realized that he was failing miserably at it. Jews were simply not converting to Christianity. So he got really frustrated, and then this frustration turned into anger, and then
mm-hmm.
at some point, this became quite vitriolic,
and
his hatred was not very different at all from what the Nazis had felt.
There are pictures from the time of the Reich when there are altars, Lutheran as well as Catholic altars, with swastikas on the altars.
Yeah, well, you know, the imagery was everywhere, and the Nazis actually used this very well.
Absolutely.
The imagery from the Middle Ages of Jews, like there was this very very famous symbol that was used everywhere in Europe called the Judensau, which is a Jewish sow, a Jewish pig, and this was a horrible icon, and it portrayed Jews sucking on this pig's teats and eating its excrement.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And usually you would see a devil in Jewish garb standing right next to these other Jews who were doing this to this pig. And so this was very common, and it was in cathedrals everywhere. As a matter of fact, it's still visible in the cathedral in Wittenberg where Luther lived in Germany.
And so it was Protestant and Catholic alike.
Yes, yeah, both of them. There was no difference at the time in terms of this kind of hatred. There was no difference. And the major difference, if you will, is that Catholicism, in particular, had more power to control this sort of thing because the Catholic Church was much more organized, and still is, as a matter of fact, than the Protestant Church. It's a giant organization, and therefore they had the power to control a little bit of what was said and what was not said by priests everywhere. They didn't control much of this, but they had the power to do it if they had wanted to.
These people all seemed to gather in this one place. I mean, there's a wonderful new book about the Mufti, when the Mufti goes and lives
Hitler.
With him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know, and all of these guys all seem to arrive at this, I always like this point in time. And they're all, and I don't even know if they even realize how they're being used. Is that fair?
Well, you could
not,
say...
Not the Mufti, because the Mufti knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah, he knew exactly what he was doing, and who was using who is an interesting question, too, because, you know, Hitler was using him, but he was using Hitler as well. So it was a mutual thing in that regard.
At the same time, inside of old Soviet Union, is there a greater anti-Semite than Joseph Stalin?
Well, I don't know if Stalin was a greater anti-Semite than Hitler, but he certainly was a big anti-Semite. You know, of course, the Soviet Union had a giant, a fairly sizable, rather, Jewish population. So the Soviets or the Russians had, you know, the notion of the pogrom and whatnot from the Cossacks happened because those Cossacks and those Russians actually had access to Jews. They saw them in little villages here and there. In Germany, they were a lot less available. You know, most Germans of World War II era never even saw a Jew.
They were gone.
They were no, because there were so few of them.
Yeah, that's what
Germany
I mean.
Had less than half of 1% of the population that was Jewish.
The real roundups took place in Poland, Ukraine, Belarus.
Yes.
That's where the real death camps were they not?
That's right. They were in Poland.
Yeah.
All the death camps were in Poland.
Yeah.
And concentration camps were in most places, but in Poland is where the Nazis chose to put the death camps. And the reason why was because they did not want them in Germany. So that was far away, that was convenient. But also because Poland had... I think it was 3 million Jews that lived there. So it was the largest population of Jews lived in Poland. It made sense for them to make the death camps there.
We're going to break for traffic. It's snowy in the city. It's 15 after the hour. The book is 6 Million Crucifixions. 6:30 KHLB on a Wednesday, the 7th of April. Hang on here. Let's do traffic. Here's Susan. Thanks, Craig. Craig Silverman, every afternoon, his colleague Dan Kaplis here on 6:30 KHLB Wednesday morning. Caca weather, but tomorrow says 61 degrees. Take a look into the 70s over the weekend. Looks great. So on the weekends here, a lot of people drive up to Central City or drive up to Blackhawk. If you've never been to the famous Bonanza, there's the deal, man. It's the famous Bonanza, and across the main street in Central is the Easy Street. Easy Street slots really are loose. The 2009 Colorado Division of Gaming Statistics are out, and penny and dollar slots are over 25% looser than the Blackhawk average. Famous Bonanza and Easy Street are giving away 3 million points in April. There's tons of prizes, 1,000 points, 5,000 in cash. On the 18th of April, there's going to be a next $5,000 grand prize giveaway. We were up there the last time. It was wonderful. And There's a across the street, an Easy Street Casino, is a wonderful, wonderful dining room. And the Mondays, you get two times the points all day, and 50 or better in terms of age, two times the points from 8 in the morning, 8 at night on Wednesdays, 8 until 8. And Fridays are cash avalanche nights up at the Central City Famous Bonanza, hot seat winners. So it's a step back in time. I mean, when they went to limited stakes gambling in Central City in Blackhawk, this place remains exactly as it was. It's an old building. Both of them are very old buildings. You can see Doc Holliday dealing stud if you close your eyes. Famous Bonanza and Easy Street. So take westbound I-70, Central City Parkway, and just right over the hill into Central City and on Main Street. There they are. Our guest is tremendous. I just really enjoy his work. 6 Million Crucifixions. He's in San Diego. Gabriel Walensky is with us. And, you know, one of the things that's always fascinated me, Gabe, is taking, you know, Germany, that really was a haven in some ways for, you know, European Jews. It produces, you know, Thomas Mann, produces Karl Marx, who himself had all problems with talking about Jews. It produces these great intellectuals, Hegel, and really, in terms of if you were Jewish, it was a place that, under the Kaiser, things were, under the Hohenzollerns, things were better than they were a lot of places in Europe, and yet incrementally, these people were able to do what they did. I find that fascinating.
Yes, and I think that to understand that, you have to also understand the way that the Germans perceived the Jews. After the French Revolution in France, the Jews were emancipated, and they were emancipated first in France, and they were allowed to come out of the ghettos. And then slowly they started to come out of the ghettos, and they were emancipated in other countries in Europe, mm-hmm. and so were they in Germany. Mm-hmm. However, there was a major difference between the way the French and the Germans perceived the Jewish population amongst them. For the French, the Jews were one more of us. You know, they were yet another French citizen, and as long as they did not stay with their own religion and their own traditions and everything completely encapsulated as they were before when they were in the ghettos, the French, you know, absorbed them into the society as regular French people, French mm-hmm. citizens. In the case of Germany, however, the Jewish population was perceived as a different entity, even as they were emancipated. Because the Germans perceived themselves, as well as the Jews, as a different ethnic community, and even as a different nation. So even during the 19th century, when the modern anti-Semitism began, they began thinking of Jews as a different nation within the German nation. So this actually grew, and over time what happened was that the anti-Semitism that evolved during the 19th century, you know, shifted from its original theological Christian position to a more modern, secular, and if you will, pseudoscientific position. It was racial in nature toward the end of the 19th century. So by the time the Nazis came to power, they had no difficulty whatsoever in harnessing this power. They already found the population that already hated Jews viscerally, because it had been growing for a very long time in Germany.
We read that Hitler gets politicized against Jews by a mayor. He's an art student, and he's, you know, a lousy art student, but he's living in these hostels and hovels, and he gets politicized. And this is before the First World War.
Yeah.
So it's laying low inside of him as a very young man. And he hears all of these stories, and he reads all of this stuff. And so his old-fashioned Semitism is right there on the surface.
It is. I mean, as you were correctly saying, it was Hitler wanted to go into art school in Vienna, mm-hmm. and he was rejected.
And they rejected him. That's right.
He was rejected because he was good just to paint postcards,
right.
and not much more. So,
yeah, no talent.
So he was rejected, and I think you're right. I think that the person who rejected him was Jewish, not because, so there was no connection between one and the other. But that, of course, just mm-hmm. fueled his hatred toward mm-hmm. Jews. But his hatred toward Jews didn't start with that, and of course,
no.
It was ingrained in him, just like in most Christians at the time. As we were saying, he was Catholic, and he imbibed all the information about Jews that was prevalent in Catholicism at the time, which was pretty nasty stuff.
It was very nasty stuff. When who is it? Is it Edward or is it Richard that expels the Jews from England?
It was done many times. It was, if I recall, it was done at least three or four times. So, and it happened over the centuries, and happened in England and many other places. It actually was a very profitable thing.
You get on the hook, and then you kick everybody out, and you don't pay them back.
Yeah, they took all their possessions and everything, and then every once in a while they would let them back in, and then a few decades later, the Jews would prosper, and they would do it again.
Now I've read historically that's what Poles and Ukrainians did in pogroms, that they would get into debt. The royal classes would into debt, into the bankers, and decided not to pay back, and then infuse a pogrom.
That's actually very possible. I mean, keep in mind that the pogroms were very violent, and many times the Jews were killed in these events. So, I suppose that back then the Jews were moneylenders, but they were not banks in the traditional sense that we think of them today. So if you kill the Jew that you owe money to, then I guess your debt is...
off the hook.
So, I'm sure that the motivation was economic in great regard.
So, but really, I mean, I just finished a book called The Jesus Wars, which is a really good book about Constantine and the beginnings. But early Christians aren't anti-Semitic, and we have some really good historians on the show that say if you would see an early Christian religious celebration, it would look like a temple. It would look like a Jewish service. And so I've read it's Gregory. And after Gregory, then the rise of this. So what do you put on that? Where do you put that?
Well, I somewhat disagree with that. I think that the early Jewish sect that was known as the Christian sect, it wasn't a separate religion at the time. It was just a group of Jews, just like Jesus and the apostles were. They actually, I wouldn't say they were anti-Semitic, and certainly not in the traditional modern sense, but they were anti-Jewish, and they became anti-Jewish. At least their successors did. After Paul started proselytized in the Gentile world, in the Roman Empire, the shift happened more or less in that time frame. And the reason why that happened was because the early Christians, if you will, had to find ways to distance themselves from the mainstream Jews. And they did this for political reasons and for religious reasons. The mainstream Jews didn't believe that Jesus was the Messiah, and of course the early Christians did.
And they weren't seeking, the Jews were not seeking converts, the Christians were.
Yeah, correctly. I mean, Jews didn't really proselytize in the same way
that they don't.
And so when Paul started to proselytize, Paul, of course, was another Jew called Saul, of Tarsus. And he started to proselytize in Syria and in Turkey and on all these other places in the Roman Empire. He actually realized that he had to find ways to make it separate from the original group. And he did a number of things. He lifted the Jewish dietary restrictions, and he lifted the circumcision restrictions. So he made it quite easy for pagans to actually join this new group.
That's the pragmatism and how it worked.
Exactly, and I think he was very he was a very capable guy too, and he was very successful. Obviously, look at today, we have over 1 billion Christians. So the reality is that he had to do that. But then there was another very important thing that happened, and in the year 66 of the Common Era, the Roman Empire was in a war with the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. It was called the Jewish War, and this went on for 7 years. In the year 70, they sacked Jerusalem and they destroyed the temple in Jerusalem, and they dispersed a bunch of Jews and sold many more into slavery. And the Christians at the time, the Christian sect at the time, had to find ways to appear in the eyes of the Romans as separate from the Jews. So they actually they needed to do this because, of course, the Romans, the Jews were a thorn on the side for the Romans. So they actually had to appear completely independent of that Jewish war.
Gabe, let me do this. I'm right at my traffic. We're having snow in the city. The book is tremendous, and it's going to get a lot of attention, and there's already a lot of angry email, which you can just expect. Gabriel Lewinsky is our guest, 6 Million Crucifixions. 8:30 on 6:30, up-to-the-minute traffic, 6:30 KHLW, snowing outside here, Susan. Thank you, Dan. Dan Kaplis every afternoon with Craig Silverman here on 6:30 KHOW Wednesday, the 7th of April. I can see by email and phone calls we're going to have Gabe back. We'll do it maybe in a week or 10 days. Snowing in the city, but it's going to make for great lawns and a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Looking ahead at the weather, looks just brilliant. So, hey, it's good stuff. You want low payments on a new Cadillac? And of course you do. Then go to Medved Cadillac. John Medved's the man, Colorado's premier Cadillac dealer. From the western slope of Colorado to Kansas, Wyoming, even as far away as Nebraska, people come to Medved Cadillac for value, service, and selection. During the Medved Cadillac Laurel event, get discounts on all-wheel drive CTSs as much as $4,500 off, or get low mileage leases on CTSs, no security deposit on approved credit. John's the man. Similar savings on the hot-selling all-wheel drive SRX. Medved Cadillac, the giant Medved Autoplex in Wheat Ridge, Rocky Mountain region's transportation hub for Cadillac. So get the best trades, highest amounts paid for trades. Medved Cadillac, I-70 Wheat Ridge, exit Kipling, exit Ward, but exit the giant Medved Autoplex. So Wednesday morning, our website, khow.com, has a link over to Gabe's work, 6 Million Crucifixions, the latest columns, a couple of different things we'll do tomorrow. That letter that was sent to one of the listeners from Mark Udall, it's really laugh out loud funny about Stephanie Villaforte. Also, the response that was written by Dick Wadhams to Pat Walk's editorial. We'll do part of that tomorrow, but it's up on the website already, khow.com. Our guest is very, very good, and we're going to have him back. There's a lot of angry emailers and callers. 6 Million Crucifixions is the book. Gabe Wilinski is our guest about the Christianity's history of anti-Semitism leading up to the most horrible of horribles, the Holocaust. And you know what's fascinating, and there's two things that I'd like you to speak to. One is, and we were talking, there's a young man who called the show this morning, and he's a college student. We were talking about, I'm a big fan of George Orwell, and how Orwell, in 1984 in Animal Farm, in his essays, talks about how you can condition people to think. And Lenin's wife, who ran the education system, knew it. The Fuhrer really knew it. Stalin knew it. Mao knew it. And how you can take a kid and over a process of time turn him into a death head man, that you can do that. Talk to that if you – and I brought this up too. In the same token, stick a 5- or 6-year-old kid into a madras today. What comes out the other side?
This is absolutely true. I mean, keep in mind that children are very malleable. And they are like sponges, and they absorb everything that adults tell them. And not only adults in general, but particularly adults that are authority figures, like parents and preachers and teachers. So when a child gets subjected to any type of education, whether good or bad, it doesn't really matter. Well, whatever education they receive early on in their childhood is what's going to stay with them. So if you tell a child from the very beginning, from the time when they start to understand language, that, you know, since we're speaking about Jewish anti-Semitism here, about Jews, and you tell them about their bad and how they killed Christ and how they did this or that or whatever, then they're going to internalize this information. And by the time they get to school, they would have this thing already ingrained in them, particularly by the time they grow up and go to church, and they get all these notions reinforced when they hear sermons of preachers telling them that Jews were the killers of Christ and that they were guilty of all kinds of problems in the world and that they were bent on destroying Christianity or defiling the Christian mind or that they, I don't know, they killed Christian boys to mm-hmm. extract their blood for their Passover matzah. Mm-hmm. So when they hear all these things throughout their entire lives, from childhood all the way to adulthood, I mean, what can you possibly expect from these people? They would obviously hate Jews, and understandably so.
If you compare this today to the madrasas, some of the madrasas, in particularly in Middle East, and I'm told, yeah. I mean, you take an unsophisticated 5 or 6-year-old kid, and you stick him in that system, and every day he's bombarded with that belief.
Yeah.
And that he's going to be in heaven, and he's going to be in paradise. And
right. There's only one potential outcome for that.
Absolutely.
I mean, these people are brainwashed from that time, from when they're 5 or 6, and there's only one thing that can happen, and that is that these people are going to absorb all that information and hate in the way they were taught to hate.
But one of the things that has always fascinated me about the Weimar Republic and the rise of the Nazis is these were an extremely well-educated group of people. These weren't fools. I mean,
no.
this wasn't going into a village in the Hindu Kush and take some kid. I mean, these are smart guys. I mean, and incrementally, step by step, I mean, through Nuremberg Acts and through Kristallnacht and the rest of it, they were willing to do it and damn near did it all.
Yeah.
And no one ever asked. I mean, those stories now, and you know, where Patton, Eisenhower doesn't even believe it, what Patton has discovered, and they bring Eisenhower in, and even Eisenhower throws up when he sees it.
Yeah.
And Eisenhower didn't believe it. They didn't believe that it could be done, and it was being done.
Well, Eisenhower actually went into the camps himself.
Yes, he did.
So.
And he threw up.
Yeah, and he actually didn't see the worst of it. Because,
no.
You know, Eisenhower was in Dachau, in Nordruf.
That's right.
And this was in Germany, and the camps in Germany were not death camps, even though many people died there.
That's right. He didn't see Belton, and he didn't see Ravensbrück, and they didn't take him there.
Well, he didn't go to Auschwitz or
right.
Majdanek or
right.
Treblinka.
That's
none
right.
of these places. These were overrun by the Russians.
The Russians.
And most of them were halfway destroyed because mm-hmm. the Germans were trying to
blow them up.
Erase the evidence.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean,
but going back to your original point about, you know, how was it that these Germans, you know, the most highly educated people in Europe at the time, did what they did? And there's a perfectly rational explanation for this. And the explanation is that, this was explained quite well by Daniel Goldhagen in Hitler's Willing Executioners.
Yeah.
In Germany, as well as other places in Europe, but Germany in particular had this eliminationist antisemitism, mm-hmm. as he called it. And this consisted of the will mm-hmm. of the German people to eliminate the Jews from amongst their midst. So they wanted to get rid of them, in mm-hmm. essence. They felt that it was a pernicious influence in Germany, and they were not part of Germany, and they were not even Germans.
But it didn't happen overnight.
It did not. No, it was a very gradual process. And again, you know, going back to what we were discussing earlier about the 19th century, when the racial antisemitism of the 19th century came around, it was a reaction to the French Revolution mm-hmm. and the ideas of modernism and the ideas of the Illustration. So what happened was that they changed all the old theocratic antisemitism in Christianity, and they transformed it into a modern lexicon. When Germany in the 19th century tried to basically moved into this particular area, they wanted to eliminate Jews from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
But eliminate at the time was not conceived of as genocide. It was they thought of, well, how can we get rid of them? Maybe push mm-hmm. them out, maybe expel them, whatever. Mm-hmm. So they were thinking of nonviolent means of elimination. But this gradually changed, and you know, you start a little grain at a time, and then by the time Hitler came to power, you had a huge hill of grains of sand of antisemitism. So by the time he came to power, the notion of elimination through genocide was not perceived as a crazy idea anymore. You know, when he started to say we need to eliminate them, at the very beginning, he didn't really mean genocide. He didn't mean we have to kill them all.
But he knew he wanted to do that.
He eventually wanted to do it, but I think he would have been happy with just getting rid of them. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, you know, early on for the first few years, he was not saying we should kill them. He was saying mm-hmm. we should get rid of them. Mm-hmm. And but this grew over time, and you know, by the time the war erupted, he knew that that was the opportunity to actually come up with what the Nazis called the final solution of the Jewish question. And final here means quite literally
final.
What that means. It was final.
What's interesting to me is, as a reader, is they would move the trains full of the Untermenschen,
mm-hmm.
and they would push the ammunition trains to the side. You know, the bullets that the soldiers needed, or the artillery shells that the soldiers needed, they would be put on the side rails so the trains could roll and kill. You read that stuff, you read it again as you get older, and maybe, you know, more lights go on in your head, and you think to myself, they truly, truly believed that.
They truly believed it, and they hated Jews more than they wanted to defend themselves, as you correctly
and
said,
happened. In the end, it was what? The Götterdämmerung. It was the twilight of the gods. And in the end, then the insanity must have been in the end of that thing. Oh, my God. You know, but they really, truly believed it.
They truly did. And the anecdote of the trains is a good one.
Yeah.
And there's many others. I mean, in the Eastern Front, mm-hmm. They continued to kill Jews, even though they desperately needed manpower to fight the Russians,
exactly.
who were coming like a bulldozer.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, it's almost like this.
Even at the very end, when the Russians were already overrunning Poland and liberating part of the death camps and whatnot, the Germans actually took the Jews out of the death camps
and moved them to kill them someplace else.
Exactly.
Now, hang on, sir. I need to pause one more time.
All right.
The book is 6 Million Crucifixions. Well, this time has really flown with this guest. It's 8:50, 10 minutes before the hour. 6:30 KHOW, Wednesday morning. Back here tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. 45 today, 61 Thursday, 69 Friday, 72 Saturday. It's good stuff. And now it's been some 70 years after the Second World War. And this man is a remarkable guest. Gabriel Wilensky is our guest. The book is 6 Million Crucifixions, The Foundation That Enables the Jews to Be Murdered by Nazis. And he is just tremendous. I mean, on and off the air, you are a remarkable guest, and I really appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you, Peter.
And the book will be out ASAP. And we're back to this, the idea of the true believer. And we were talking about even in the finality. But then one of the more interesting aspects too is when Nazis roll into the Ukraine or into Poland, the Wehrmacht goes and the death heads go. The Ukrainians welcome these guys as liberators, and that's part that no one really talks about. And then they realize that they've gotten someone far worse than the Soviets. But the Ukraine had been through the purge of the kulaks and the devastation that the Russians put on the Ukrainians and the starvation. Here comes the Nazis, and they're pointing out the Jews. They're showing they're helping. And the same thing in Poland. Can you speak to that?
Absolutely, they were willing collaborators, and they did it very willingly. As a matter of fact, when the Germans conquered all these various different countries, they recruited the locals to do their dirty work, and they created divisions even of Waffen-SS and other members of the army, mm-hmm. and they got people from all these various different countries. But by the way, not just on the Eastern Front,
Spain?
Because they did it also in France and Poland.
Sure.
So it was just not necessarily people in the Eastern European countries, but people in the Eastern European countries had one particular characteristic, and that was that they were very willing to participate in the German army or the SS, but they were also very willing to kill Jews.
Mm-hmm.
The people in the East European countries hated Jews just as much as the Germans did. And they wanted to deport them and to get rid of them, and they wanted to kill them. And,
mm-hmm.
and as a matter of fact, they did kill them. The Einsatzgruppen, which were mobile killing squads Germans had roving behind the Wehrmacht in the Eastern Front,
mm-hmm.
had recruited the locals to do the actual killing. So they put rows of Jews in front of mass graves, and they pulled the trigger of machine guns. Mm-hmm. And this was done in great part by the Ukrainians and the Latvians and sometimes Poles. Mm-hmm. And, because it was really horrible, dirty work that the Germans were having psychological difficulties with.
They were. That's right. They would come back and they would be... They would be crazy.
It was, of course. But even for the Germans, it didn't really matter how much. It doesn't really matter how much you hate someone. It has to affect you to kill someone, mm-hmm. In the way they did, and kill mothers holding babies, mm-hmm. and all these other people, elderly and whatnot, in kill them one by one or kill them in rows with a machine gun. All this stuff has to get to you. There's no way that this will not affect someone.
It's they're incredible stories, and in the centerpiece of all of this is Western faith.
It's Western faith, and Christianity, unfortunately, laid the foundation for this hatred, and it grew from there. Of course, the hatred that was laid down in the foundation in Christianity was not racial, for the most part. Although there was racial anti-Semitism in the church as well, but it was mostly a theological. As a matter of fact, there's an interesting quote that, if you don't mind, I can read real quick.
Please.
That Adolf Hitler said, and he said, "The Catholic Church considered the Jews pestilent for 1,500 years, mm-hmm. put them into ghettos, etc., because it recognized Jews for what they were. I am moving back toward the time in which a 1,500-year-old tradition was implemented. I recognize the representatives of this race as pestilent for the state and for the Church, and perhaps I am thereby doing Christianity a great service for pushing them out of schools and public functions."
Yeah.
This quote comes from a conversation that Hitler had with two bishops. One, I think, was a cardinal, and they were German members of the German Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And the Catholic Church was concerned about the extent of the anti-Semitism that Hitler was espousing, and that's when Hitler told them that. Said, "Look, who are you to come to pontificate to me about me being too anti-Semitic, when it was the church who did, considered them just as I read that quote?" Because Hitler knew very well that the hatred had come from there, and he was not really inventing much. As a matter of fact, this is an interesting thing as well. The things that we traditionally associate with Nazi anti-Semitism, the Jewish Star of a David that mm-hmm. they were forced to wear on the clothes.
Mm-hmm. That had been done before.
This was actually instituted by the Catholic Church sure. centuries before. Sure. It was a Jewish circle mm-hmm. and a Jewish conical hat that Jews were forced to wear during the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. and for exactly the same reason, so that Christians could identify them as Jews and stay away. Yeah. The ghettos that the Germans created, where they put the Jews in horrible small places in various different cities before they deported them to concentration camps. The ghettos were also an invention of the church. Mm-hmm. It had been instituted by the church about 800 years before, and it was put officially into Catholic edicts in the 15th century. So the ghettos were not an invention of the Nazis, it was an invention of the Catholic Church. And the prohibition to work in most professions was not an invention of the Nazis either. This was also instituted by the church. The prohibition from teaching in schools and from being doctors, all this stuff was had come from the church as well.
And it even, of course, was in this country for forever as well, with the so-called quotas. And so nothing is, you are a tremendous guest. We've gotten a lot of, obviously, people angry about what you're saying. I look at history in the sense of tell the truth, make up your own mind, and don't be angry about someone who tells the truth, because that's all they do.
I agree, but the one thing I would want your angry listeners to think about is, I understand that the things that I'm saying may not be palatable, and they may not like it. But as you were saying, these things are based on the historical record.
Sure.
I invite them to read the book There's other books as well. I don't necessarily want to push my book here, but you know, there's other books as well on the subject, and they can go to the library and read about these things. This is not new information in the sense that I unearthed a document that shows the church did this. This is something that is well known and it's well documented. So I welcome criticism, but I also would like these listeners to have an open mind and read the book and then make up their mind. Okay. I mean, if they feel that the information is all false and based on just on my opinion, then fine.
So
but,
be
you
it.
Know,
yeah.
Hopefully that will.
We have our music. You gave us a tremendous time this morning, Gabe. We'll have you back. The book is 6 Million Crucifixions. Thank you so much for being on the show, Gabe.
Thank you. And one last point is that the book is available now
on
Amazon and so on.
I thought we had advanced. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Be safe.
Take care.
Everybody. We'll do it again tomorrow morning. Look at the website, khow.com. There's a link to his work and a whole lot of other things. Well, the sun just popped out. It's good news. See you in the morning. We're down in the shadows. And the perverted.